Welcome to another edition of Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host for today's show, Ken Jones. If you're a writer or an artist or composer or really anyone doing something creative, you might have been filled at one time with self-doubt. It's very common for even the most successful artists to feel they're just not good enough. And this can hamper their creativity, sometimes to the point of paralysis. Our Radio Zine guest today, Philip Kenny, has written a book on how to navigate your way out of this mindset. It's called The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity, which was recently selected as a finalist for Best Nonfiction Book of the Year by Red City Review. Philip's a Portland-based writer and psychotherapist who, over the past 30 years of practice, has treated a number of people going through the emotions and stresses of the creative life, and he's personally experienced it in his own work as an author. At the age of 60, Philip made a list of things he was sure he couldn't do and set about doing them. Out of that personal challenge came Philip's first book, the novel Radiance, published in 2012. That was followed by two poetry collections, Days of Magic and Where Roses Bloom. And he recently published an essay in the Timberline Review called The Rebirth of Masculinity, What We Can Learn from Harvey Weinstein and Company. We're fortunate to have Philip with us now to talk about the writer's crucible, how to overcome self-doubt, the roots of creative work, and the rebirth of masculinity in light of the Me Too movement. Philip Kenny, thanks for being here on KBOO.
Thanks, Ken. I'm happy to be here.
Philip, let's start with that list we mentioned in the intro. At the age of 60, you wrote down the things you were sure at the time that you could never do. An unusual way to celebrate this milestone. What led up to the decision to make that list?
Well, what led up to it was aging and turning 60, which seemed monumental to me. And I was never fond of the whole idea of the bucket list, but I did feel like it was a good time to challenge myself, especially since I'd been writing poems for a number of years. So I thought, well, let's see, what do I believe I cannot do? And let's challenge that and have some fun with it. So number one on the list was playing the piano.
And you didn't go about accomplishing that. And that was because
I was right about that. I could not play the piano.
And that was because of physical disabilities?
Not a disability, but just my left hand seems barely connected to my neurology. So I have about a 10-second lag trying to make the chord changes.
Always behind the beat.
Always behind.
But
one-handed piano tunes were fine. No, I'll just.
But the novel Radiance came out of that.
So I sat. Then I turned to the novel, and I was completely intimidated. But my wife just said, "Well, you know, just write 20 minutes a day, 20 minutes at a time." So I did. I sat down and I decided to just go very slowly and listen. So I would sit. And I wasn't trying to think of a clever thing to say. I was trying to listen to what came to mind. The other thing with writing a novel that would intimidate me was dialogue. I was sure I could not write dialogue.
And did you do any studying of how to write novel, how to write dialogue in particular?
No. Oh,
just sat down and started.
But, you know, I was an English major, so I've read a ton of novels. But I realized there was a psychological block that my father and I had been very distant. He was a very reticent man, and I always felt uncomfortable. We couldn't talk. So I understood that soon into the writing that I was projecting that onto the effort. And I had a thought one day. I said, this is nonsense. I spend my whole day in dialogue with people as a psychotherapist.
So
you know what people sound like.
Yeah.
So it was one of those remarkable projections of an internal belief system that was utterly false. And that freed me up enormously. And I began to, you know, write the book and include dialogue, and it went quite well.
And you mentioned it almost came too easy, it seemed, from what you wrote. You were done in 7 months with a novel. A lot of novelists will labor years on their manuscript.
Well, that was the first draft, you know. Uh-huh. So, it was quite a bit to do after that. But, yeah, after 6 or 7 months, I found myself writing the end at the conclusion of a 93,000 word manuscript. Now, you say it came easy. So that's an interesting thing because, and this is something I write about in The Writer's Crucible a lot, a great deal of the material came to me unbidden. I was often awakened in the middle of the night with whole sentences and paragraphs streaming through my mind, and I would, you know, get up and stagger to a writing notebook and try to write them down, and often in the morning they were illegible. But I found that tremendously exhilarating and also confidence building. It took a lot of the pressure off because I felt if I listened enough, it would come to me. And it wasn't up to me to be brilliant or super smart or clever. It was more a matter of listening and being quiet, and material came.
A lot of writers describe that feeling as channeling.
Yes.
Rather than sitting down and actually actively writing.
Yes. I think a lot of people do. If you talk to them, there's a common experience. There's a much that can come unbidden. I prefer other words to channeling, but I think it's the same notion that it's to me, it's a matter of listening and a communication and a connection with an inner source of creativity, which I think is synonymous with one's inner being. So that the whole process to me becomes an act of creativity, but also a spiritual practice of listening and connecting with that creative impulse.
Now, how did you feel when you finished the manuscript? It must have been extreme. You used the word exhilarating. That it must have been almost ecstatic. Here's something you put on your list that you could never do it, and here you had done it.
You know, it's very true. It was ecstatic. I think that's not an exaggeration. And for a couple of reasons, not simply because I did it, but also because I realized something in the process. First of all, the act of writing Radiance was tremendously enlivening. But it also brought it clear to me. It made an integration and a synthesis between aspects of my life that had been very important to me, but felt somewhat disjointed. Psychology, spirituality. I'd been practicing psychology for close to 40 years, meditating for close to 40 years. And they were great, except that they did not seem cohesive to my life. I'd finish meditating in the morning, often have blissful meditations, walk out the door of the meditation room and be pissed off.
Welcome to the world.
Yeah, it's the world, that thing, the world. So, but I found that writing and creativity integrated spirituality, which I call being in the book, psychology, emotional life, and creative life. They all came together so that all of a sudden things felt more seamless.
Which is a perfect transition from your early writing experience here, at least past the age of 60, and then the book we are talking about today, The Writer's Crucible.
Yeah.
Now we mentioned you're both a therapist and a writer. And did the book get its inspiration from your experiences as a psychotherapist and some of the clients you saw, or your own experiences as a writer when you sat down to write Radiance and then a lot of the poems you wrote?
Yes, both, really, because I do see a number of artists and writers and creative people of all sorts. And, of course, I was writing myself and having my own difficulties, some of which I probably passed over in the last couple of questions. But of course, everybody struggles some.
Right.
And so I understand those dark days when you feel helpless, when you're trying to listen or trying to make things happen and they don't. And sometimes those days can go on and on. But between the people I was working with and a few interviews I did for an online magazine called Lit Reactor, with a dear friend of mine whose name is Aaron Littlewood. At the time it was Aaron Real. She asked me to, she was in the publishing business and asked me to do a few interviews on depression and anxiety and writers. So we did those. They were quite successful. And at the end of them, she said, well, really, you should write a book about this.
Aaron to thank.
You have Aaron to thank. And, you know, I kind of passed it over. And then, I don't know, a couple of years later, the seed germinated. And all of a sudden I said, I really should. So I was up at Timberline Lodge one day, took my son and his friends skiing, and I was sitting in the, you know, in the beautiful dining hall by the fireplace, and it just came to me. The whole outline of the book came. I wrote down the whole outline. Off we go.
Now, you mentioned depression. I was wondering, yeah. Is there a connection here between depressed people tend to write, become writers, or the act of writing kind of makes you a bit more depressed than you normally would?
Yeah, both. But if you weren't depressed before or anxious, you will be. It's like my favorite line from the book is that Flannery O'Connor quote. Do you remember that one?
Is that from the very beginning?
From the front, yeah, where she says the act of writing a novel.
Oh, I've got it right here, yeah. Did you want to read it for us? It's just right over here.
Okay. Yeah. Writing a novel is a terrible experience during which the hair often falls out and the teeth decay.
And so, she was one of our best writers. So
she was.
If she could go through that, and yet you can't feel bad.
That's right.
About the things that come up in our own practices.
Well, it normalizes it. And this is what I try to do in the book, to normalize some of these what we think of as dark feelings of depression or anxiety, particularly I refer to it as the problems of self-doubt and insecurity, and that they're part of the terrain, and that experiencing those feelings doesn't mean that something's wrong with you as an artist. It means probably you're on track.
I want to talk about the title too, Philip, yeah. Because right above that Flannery O'Connor quote in the epilogue,
yes.
You define crucible, which is, of course, the book's name, The Writer's Crucible, as a situation of severe trial or in which different elements interact, leading to the creation of something new. What do you consider the writer's crucible?
Well, really just what we were referring to, the dark hours when you feel helpless, when nothing's coming, you feel very much like you're in the wrong, you know, vocation, and the anxiety of and the self-doubt, is this any good? You know, most writers are familiar with the experience of mornings writing, or you've been working on something for a day or a week, and you read it over, and there comes the hammer. You know, this sucks. This is terrible. I can't write. Who am I kidding? It's quite an active voice in most people.
You're listening to Radio Zine on Cable Community Radio. We're talking today with Philip Kenny, author of The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity, which was recently selected as a finalist for Best Nonfiction Book of the Year by Red City Review. You talk in the book about how writers are actually working on two things at the same time, even though they might not realize it. That's the writing project itself, for example, the novel, yeah. Radiance for you, yeah. But also something you call the self project. What do you mean by the self project?
Well, yeah, can I just finish that last question
a little bit?
Because the writer's crucible, you know, it is sometimes feels like walking on hot coals. It can be excruciating at times. But in the definition, a situation of severe trial in which different elements interact, leading to the creation of something new. It's the creation of something new that comes from this, what is sometimes an ordeal. And sometimes it's a great delight, but it's the something new that I find fascinating. And I think is the experience of many writers, because many writers end up in a much different place than where they started, thinking they were going. So I think that's terrific. Now, there are several things that can interfere along the way, and one of them is what I call the self-project. And the self-project is commonly thought of as the ego, but I think the way we think of ego is limited and often is simply referring to like a psychic mechanism, usually having to do with inflation. But the self project is really all of the maneuvers, the strategies, the fantasies of trying to compensate for a sense of lack, of not being good enough, trying to combat the internal narrative of I am not enough.
What would be an example? What would be somebody's self-project as opposed to their actual writing project at the time? Would they be saying...
Can I give you an old example?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Just to lighten it up a little.
Okay.
When I was in grade school, I moved from Ohio to New York, and where everything changed, and I discovered rock and roll, an American Bandstand. So I bet my brother $5 I'd have a hit record by the time I turned 13.
Wow. Kind of the Justin Bieber of the time.
Yeah, that's right. But
so you were kind of inflating your own ego to kind of compensate for the fact that you really didn't think you were going to have a hit record, or you really weren't that musically
inclined. Well, no, the thing is, what happened is I went up to my room, but did I practice the guitar 2 hours a night? No. I went up there and basically fantasized about being a rock star. Because I felt a tremendous sense of deficit in myself. I had felt, you know, the early vague notion that I wasn't good enough, and was carrying a lot of bad feelings and shame about myself. And so the fantasy helped me in that moment to escape those feelings, to push them aside.
Which wouldn't necessarily be bad, but it interfered with your ability to accomplish that
goal. It's not bad because it was a way I was trying to struggle and with these bad feelings and the sense that I wasn't enough.
But
so
what
it's
was
not bad.
What was bad, though, Philip, was you weren't practicing the guitar and working on your music.
I didn't have the internal fortitude to go through the challenging times of learning an instrument.
So this
and
self-project...
that applies to creative work. Mm-hmm. You know that people, of course, for good reasons, are hoping to be bestsellers or hoping to make a great book, and that many people just try too hard to be clever. They're worrying about the reviews before they even send it out, and any number of things that relate more to what I call the self project and less to listening to the muse. And it can get quite confusing too. And one of my favorite things in the book is why I say that you can mistake the stirrings of the promptings of the self-project for the stirrings of the muse.
How would you confuse those? You would think the muse is telling you you're going to be the rock star at age
13.
Well,
not that not necessarily that, but that you might mistake your attempts to be extra clever and witty they're forced. They're somehow have too much of your desire in them and not enough of keeping with the storyline, for instance, or the tone of the book. So you kind of lose the track by following the self-project, the stirrings of this. Is that clear? Did that make sense?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that that's where you get into trouble, when the self-project, which isn't necessarily bad, if it keeps you going, interferes with the authenticity of what you're working on.
Yes.
Your inner being is kind of being taken over by these projections
of
success and greatness or whatever else.
Yeah, and usually the projections of success or greatness translate into, you know, more practical difficulties with the writing. Like I said, where you're trying too hard, or you're trying too hard to be clever, or you're not sticking to the essence of the story.
Now, the subtitle of the book is Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity.
Yes.
I was thinking, why not something more practical, like how to cure writer's block?
I know.
It seems like you're after something a little higher here than a self-help book, or, which a subtitle like that would imply. I mean the one that I suggested. Philip, change it to How to Cure Writer's Block. You'll sell a million.
I know. I've criticized myself for that many times.
But certainly there was a good reason why you chose that subtitle.
Well, maybe I had some self-project of my own going in the choice of the title, wanting to sound smart or erudite or what have you. But I did also, and it's part of the poet in me, I didn't want it to. It's not just a self-help book, you know. It's not a simple exercise on, a how-to book. It's more on how to be a writer, and I wanted to go into depth because many of the books that I've read on helping writers through tough times, they can be good, but they also simplify the problem. I think they talk about either cognitive strategies. Or to overcome some of these feelings, or they talk about a new perspective. And that's fine. It's good to a point, but it doesn't really go the difference, because while we talked about these insecurities and self-doubts that come up with writing as being normal and being okay, there's also a layer to most people of historical or psychological material that really compounds the struggle with the emotions that arise, so that people who have experienced traumas or people who have never felt heard are going to have compounded insecurities about their book being received. They're going to have feelings that come up that can overwhelm them and interfere with the work. And so this book goes into more depth of the psychological origins of some of the emotions writers face.
And of course, that's your field.
Yeah, that's
my main field is psychotherapy.
And that's what I do with many, many authors and artists.
I was going to ask you, when a writer first comes to you for treatment, how do you even begin? Do you find out more about their project, what they're working on, or a little bit about their past life, maybe some of the issues they have, like you had with your dad?
The first thing I do with anybody, but you know, maybe in particular writers and artists, is I try to get a very thorough understanding of their experience. You know, how are they suffering? What are the emotional problems that are interfering with the work? I have one very brilliant artist who's afraid, really, of being big, as good as he is, because he remembers being told when he was in expansive states as a child that he was being too big for his britches.
Ah, yeah.
Of course, I understand that because I grew up in Ohio and in the Midwest. Talking about yourself is like a cardinal sin, being expansive and exuberant.
I think that's a universal experience as a kid, being told.
Yeah, don't be a braggart. You're too big for your britches, yeah. And so I try to start with a really thorough appreciation for the emotional state people are in, and how that is maybe compounded in the course of the work, the artistic work.
How did you transfer that to the printed page here? Here you're taking a lot of your face-to-face experiences, one-on-one experiences with patients in psychotherapy, writers who are having problems with the self-project that you defined. How do you transfer that to the book? I noticed you also had what you call experiments in there.
Yes.
Which are kind of exercises in a way for the reader.
Yeah. Well, I wanted it to also be a book that is experiential. So I put in a lot of exercises. Let's take, for instance, one of the central components of the book is the understanding that the not good enough internal narrative and self-talk is organized primarily around the feeling of shame. So one of the exercises in the book goes into depth on shame and inquires about shameful experiences people may have had in their lifetime. So that, I hoped, gave people a way to really chew on the material and keep it from being too intellectualized.
Too abstract.
Too abstract.
That right away they can apply it to themselves by coming up with, what are the shameful moments in their life? What do they feel shame about?
Yes.
yeah. and personalizes it.
And shame's really at the heart, in my opinion, of what is can be so paralyzing and difficult in a creative life. Because you're really putting yourself out there. People are really pretty naked with their self-presentation. And yeah. So there's all sorts of opportunities to feel.
Now, I'm kind of guessing we probably have some writers and other artists today who are listening
yeah.
and who are facing the writer's crucible, maybe the self-project. If there's one thing they can start working on today, what would you suggest? Other, of course, than buying the book and starting to go through it.
You know, the book is a good starter, I think. And I believe in therapy. Therapy works. Sometimes it gets a bad rap. But I think if people particularly have trauma in their background or suffer depression, anxiety, or very strong emotional states that interfere with their work or their lives, therapy is a good thing. I believe in meditation. Meditation or yoga practices help calm the system, help center, and help a person tune in to the internal world, which I think links to the creative source. And people don't like me for this, but I think, you know, food and I suggest a lot of people with anxiety cut out coffee and for a couple of weeks and see how they feel. Most of them.
Because it's such a difficult thing to do, yeah.
So, yeah, they curse, but they feel better. And so those kinds of things, exercise. But and of course, creativity. Creativity is a great way to enter into the stream of life.
Yeah, I like the way that you described working on radiance as a way of kind of bringing these different threads in your life together.
Yes, that's I love that. I think that's really true for people. And people can work out some emotional difficulties in the course of writing or doing art. Absolutely. I have one person I work with, this tremendous painter, and she came in with a lot of grief, and I suggested she paint her sadness and paint her rage. And it was quite transforming. It moved things along for her.
She became somewhat unblocked by doing that connected more with her work.
Unblocked, more able to move with and experience her emotions, because a lot of people come in and are very frightened of their emotions. So they try to get away from them, or they enlist the self-project to help circumvent the experience.
It's almost like self-medication there, but not necessarily therapeutic.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it just keeps coming back. You know, it might work for a little while, but the difficulties will come back if they're not addressed. So
I wanted to get to the essay that we talked about, just touch on it, and it's called The Rebirth of Masculinity, What We Can Learn from Harvey Weinstein and Company.
Yes.
And that's in the Timberline Review,
yes.
Which is out now. Readers wanted to get a hold of it, listeners wanted to get a hold of it. I love the way you began that essay. It was a personal memory of the first time you saw a James Bond movie, and this was Goldfinger.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So, you know, I was 15. I was skinny. I'd grown 8 inches in a year. Beard was coming out. I had acne. Felt like a complete freak.
And you would move from Ohio to New York.
New York, which was light years ahead of where we had been socially. So I went to see Goldfinger with some friends. And of course, you know, Goldfinger, James Bond, he was the answer to the self-project because he was omnipotent.
Yes.
And he was also, as we see now, you know, a sexual predator. And at the last scene in the movie where he throws Pussy Galore to the ground, who had up till then been portrayed pretty much as an equal, very smart, bright, good businesswoman, and gutsy, sexy. He threw her to the floor of the barn in the hay and jumped on her and forced her into what then appeared like she was joining his desire, but it was really an exation, I think, of her desire, which is, you know, what we're seeing.
And the history of cinema is full of scenes like that.
Full of scenes like that. So he became forever implanted in our young, anxious minds as a model for who we were supposed to be and how to be. And from there, then I go into talking about psychoanalytic concepts of repression, and And the Freud's theory of the return of the repressed, which is a little hard to talk about right now, but in this short time, but
it's well worth seeking out the essay. I think there's a lot of great thought that goes into it.
Good.
I did want to ask you one more question on the
sure.
essay, though, Philip. Given our current situation with sexual abusers in power, and you don't even mention the worst there. You don't mention Bill Cosby, Donald Trump, Supreme Court Justice, unfortunately, Brett Kavanaugh.
Yes.
They're in power, seemingly untouchable. Hopefully that's not the case, but that's what it seems like some days. And the advent of the Me Too movement, which hopefully can counteract that. Do you have any hope we can make that transformation as men?
Oh, well, you know, they're not completely untouchable. Bill Cosby is in prison.
Oh, that's true. I guess I'm thinking more Kavanaugh.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I go back and forth. I have hopeless days and days where I'm not hopeless. You know, I have two boys who are recently gone off to college, once 20, once 22. And I've watched those kids grow up with their friends, and they're different. They are really different. They are smart. They are savvy to this problem of rape culture. They're respectful, and they're aware.
I see that with my sons.
Do you?
Who are
yeah.
a little older than your sons.
Yeah.
But, more tolerant and less discriminating, I think.
Right.
Just because of the world they grew up in is just wider and more diverse, and it's very difficult to hate people that you actually know and interact with every day.
So I don't have a whole lot of hope for our generation.
we'll all be dead soon, I guess.
I think. I hope the world is still going, but I have a fair amount for them, for their generation and younger generations. I mean, it's a tough thing, and you know, with our culture. And one of the things that I stressed in the interview, I talked a lot about little boys. And the need.
Oh, yeah, in the essay.
In the essay. Uh-huh. In the essay. And the need to help boys and men understand and accept in their inner world. And that much of what men do to women, I defined as a projection of their own shame, that they project shame and disgust into women, which I think many carry with them themselves. It's very much
a repression of their inner life.
Yeah.
Now, on that pessimistic and optimistic note, pessimistic for our generation, optimistic for our sons and beyond, I wonder, Philip, can you tell our listeners where to find out more about your work and, in particular, The Writer's Crucible and the essay we discussed?
Well, I am a huge proponent of independent bookstores. So you can find The Writer's Crucible at Broadway Books on 18th and Broadway, Northeast Portland. I strongly urge people to find the book there, not on you know who.
Right. But you have your own website too.
I have a website. It's Philip with one L, small letters, hyphen Kenny, Kenney, at or .com rather. And the Timberline Review, you can also find it at Broadway Books or online, or I think probably Powell's or Annie Bloom's has it as well.
And they're both very fine independent bookstores.
Yeah, they're fine independent bookstores. Yeah, that's the way to go.
Well, Philip Kenny, thanks very much for joining us on KBOO this morning.
My pleasure. Been great. Thanks, Ken.
We've been talking with Philip Kenny, author of The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity, which was recently selected as a finalist for Best Nonfiction Book of the Year by Red City Review. You can learn more about Philip and the book on his website, Philip, one L, hyphen Kenny, K-E-N-N-E-Y, .com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Philip for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.